Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. I'm Adam Bolton. Worldview is the podcast where we speak to leading scholars and experts to unpick the big themes shaping global affairs. This is the second of a six-part series reflecting on war in Ukraine. Today we're going to focus on President Putin's Russia. In 1938, the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain referred to Hitler's threat to invade as a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. A year later, the Germans did invade Poland, triggering the Second World War. 84 years on, there is now a war caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which threatens to change the world order again. We live in an interconnected digital world, but how much do we really know of the quarrel between these two countries? How does the West see Russia? And how does Russia see the West and itself? We'll get two expert views in this podcast. Later, I'll speak to Sir Roderick Lyne, former British ambassador to Moscow. First, I spoke to the Russian-born Vladislav Zubok, Professor of International History at the London School of Economics and head of the Russian International Affairs Programme at LSE Ideas, about Vladimir Putin's sense of grievance.
Well, it's not a matter of justice. It's a matter of how historical actors, and in this case, President of Russia, Putin, looks at the past. For most of Western statesmen and Western public, the whole thing happened simply because of degeneration of Russian authoritarianism and because of Putin's innate tendency to use violence. But I think the reason in his own mind was above all the geopolitical impasse that he convinced himself Russia was in, and this impasse, in his view, was created by Eastern enlargement of NATO and Eastern enlargement of the European Union. So when we discuss NATO enlargement...
Let's actually go right back, because you were growing up in Russia in the 1990s. Let's take the genesis of this as being the fall of the Berlin Wall and the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, at that stage, how did Russia, or how did Gorbachev and followed by Yeltsin, how did they see Ukraine?
I don't think at this time we can speak of Ukraine as a central factor. Two lines in the Kremlin, so to speak. One line is by Gorbachev. And Gorbachev, as we remember, wanted to preserve the Soviet Union, not its old authoritarian, post-authoritarian mode, of course, but as a refurbished voluntary union that would especially include Russia and Ukraine. And this reformed union, according to Gorbachev, would be included into another superstructure that is a common European home. Gorbachev referred to this common European home beginning with 1990 and 1987, particularly 89, before the collapse of the wall. And in his view, this sort of would be a security architecture of Europe that would prevent wars, not only, you know, wars between old sovereign states, but between sort of new sovereign states, such as Russia and Ukraine. So this line, as we know, failed, right? And it failed to a great extent because the Russian Federation and Ukraine wanted to be independent. And we always say, oh, Ukraine became independent, but we forget to say that the Russian Federation also strove for independence at the very same time, in parallel.
That is interesting, isn't it? Because that would give the lie to the claim that Ukraine's always been part of Russia, if right back then they were identified as two independent republics, the Russian Federation and Ukraine.
Well, we're not talking about semantics. We're talking about historical memories and imagination.
Sure.
And in the West, for many people, well, even recently, Russia was the Soviet Union. So hence comes this major misinterpretation of what happened in 1991. For many Americans and American leaders, the Soviet Union was just another form for Russia's existence. So if you take this, Ukraine was part of Russia. But if you consider the map of the Soviet Union, you find 15 republics. created there under Lenin, Stalin, and so on and so forth. And the Russian Federation became independent within the boundaries drawn under the Soviets. And this Russian Federation wanted to be sovereign and independent. But what Yeltsin, President Yeltsin, who became the first elected leader of the Russian Federation, wanted, he dismissed Gorbachev's line, but he still wanted Russia to be part of the common European home, but in a new guise, as a sovereign Russia within its borders. As Yeltsin wanted to do that, he recognized Ukraine's independence as another Slavic republic within the former Soviet Union, in expectation that A, both of them would be part of a common European and Western architecture of security, and B, that Russia was so more powerful, you know, have all this wealth, oil, and gas resources, that by definition, Russia would be a senior partner and Ukraine perhaps would be a slightly more junior partner. And this sort of architecture, this kind of, you know, calculation by Yeltsin, I think was shattered in subsequent years by NATO Eastern enlargement. And by the fact that gradually, and this is a complicated story, why the United States and many statesmen in the United States began to treat Ukraine and Russia separate calculations. You know, Ukraine suddenly began to look more promising for the United States than Russia that, you know, plunged into war in Chechnya, became more authoritarian, and so on and so forth.
Let's look at it, if you like, from the other perspective, the Western perspective at the time of the fall in Berlin Wall. I was covering a lot of the international diplomacy there. And my recollection of that, with things like the offer of partnership to peace to former Soviet countries and all the rest of it, was that this idea of a common European homeland was not one that was immediately rejected within Europe, but it was one that it would take a lot of time to achieve. After all, the two blocks, if you like, had been at a state of standoff all during the Cold War, and it wasn't suddenly going to happen overnight. And there were the, you know, the invitations subsequently to become part of the G8 as it became. So what I'm really saying is it fair, and I've read your papers, is it really fair to say that the West was pushing away Russia during this period of the 1990s?
No. Of course, I wouldn't say that. The West did not push away Russia. But the idea was created of different spaces of, if you like, European unity. And one space was NATO. When, you know, all of a sudden, Bill Clinton first offered to Yeltsin the partnership of peace, that's sort of a common zone for all members, all states in Eastern Europe, plus Russia, Ukraine, and others who were not NATO members. And that was one space. And all of a sudden, Clinton made a pivot and agreed to include three Central European countries, Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary, into NATO. And that was the beginning of hasty, in some way, expansion of NATO. And that kind of flip-flopped everything, particularly from the perspective of people around Yeltsin. Yeltsin was very upset, in fact, quite furious, it's on the record. So as a sort of conciliation prize, Clinton gave Russia a founding act, and a sort of a place in G7 that became G8, but that didn't obfuscate for the Russian elites the fact that suddenly Russia was treated differently from Eastern Europeans. And, you know, during the same time, and this is still less known, Ukraine became more and more viewed like, if you like, closer to Eastern Europe, closer to Poland, and having to be treated differently from Russia. And in fact, there was a line to a certain extent of dividing Ukraine and Russia. This line was present, by the way, when even after the, you know, Berlin Wall fell, inside the Bush, you know, Herbert Walker Bush administration, there was a line of Pentagon and Dick Cheney who said explicitly during the discussion that the smaller the Russians are, the better for us. You know, in other words, if Ukraine is split and is not part of what is Russian empire and imperial sphere of influence, that's in American sphere of influence. And that kind of began to gain more and more influence inside the U.S. Circles, and various actions of Russia and various actions of Ukraine, such as the Orange Revolution and others, kind of added fuel to this.
Let's go back to 1991. How serious do you think that offer was from President Clinton? What was he really envisaging when he said that he'd left the door open for Russia's eventual membership of NATO?
Oh, I think this is the claim that cannot be corroborated. I wonder why Clinton made this claim, because it's not corroborated by historical record. In fact, Yeltsin and then his successor, Vladimir Putin, several times raised the issue of Russia's membership in NATO. True, they wanted some perks and conditions and so on and so forth. And some American diplomats now say that, okay, Russia didn't want to be just the last country in line for NATO membership. It wanted to be the first. It still wanted to get some special deal within NATO, which was completely unacceptable. But that, I think, obfuscates the main point. From the very start, NATO was not for Russia. And there was never any serious discussion under what conditions, under what implications the Russian Federation could become a member of NATO, in contrast to Ukraine. Ukraine was finally granted that.
Well, I want to come on to that, but I just go about this. 1991, how serious was Russia about joining NATO? Was it actually really wanted to become part of NATO, or was it really just looking to dismantle the defensive alliance and have a sort of open Europe?
No. I think, you know, we shouldn't conflate the Soviet desire, early desire. I mean, remember Molotov offered in 1954 that the Soviet Union should join NATO. That was a ruse, of course, to destroy NATO unity. In 1991, immediately after signing off the death warrant to the Soviet Union, Boris Yeltsin sent his strategist, Gennady Burbulis, to the Brussels, and he offered in extreme seriousness that Russia wants to be part of NATO. Russia wants to build an absolutely new architecture to make any conflict, any war in Europe unthinkable and impossible. And it was a lot of rhetoric on Yeltsin's part how that was, in their opinion, the real end of the Cold War. And later on, when Americans kept saying, oh, no, there are problems, that became a moving target. And inside Russia, and even around Yeltsin, a different kind of mythology full of suspicions, dark premonitions began to gain currency that actually NATO and America just wanted to destroy Russia, not the Soviet Union. And the whole, you know, conspirology about Western involvement began to grow and grow and grow. And Russian liberals complained openly. Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev, who, you know, is very much around and can confirm or deny, he repeatedly told his Western friends and partners, listen, the longer you hold us in a sort of twilight zone, the more we'll lose to our nationalists, the more we'll lose to our conservatives. And that was absolutely true.
But how practical was really this idea of Russia joining NATO or of having a common Europe?
How practical it was to offer an eventual membership to Ukraine in 2008. I would argue the same thing could have been done whether you got to Russia by, you know, setting certain terms, setting certain conditions, but it was never done. And I think, and I'll speak as one of the liberal Russians, that really, I think, was not a central cause of a triumph of authoritarianism and xenophobia and the new course of Putin and all that. You can repeat it. But that was a certain factor that was in the back of Russians' mind.
Well, I mean, there was also the question of nuclear disarmament, wasn't there? And Ukraine ultimately disarmed. And of course, Russia wasn't willing to do that.
No, Russia was willing to cooperate very much with the United States and the UK to make all nuclear weapons on the former Soviet territory safe for the world. And that was a tremendous partnership program that should be remembered. So at that time, Russia was totally cooperative. And I think if we imagine some kind of even loose, not a map, as in case of Ukraine, but a loose promise that Russia would too, in the future, may become a member of NATO. That would have been very, very, very helpful for those who argued against traditional, if you like, Russian xenophobia, traditional Russian anti-Westernism, anti-Americanism, and so on and so forth.
I mean, let's go on now to 2008 NATO summit in Bucharest, which I covered. And I would have to say that this perception that that was somehow a provocative summit, in as much as it said that one day Ukraine and indeed Georgia could join NATO. To me, it was a manana statement, which was basically saying that they wouldn't be joining anytime soon, and therefore was to a certain extent asserting their practical neutrality. And of course, we do know that within months, Russia went into Georgia. So that was also presumably with very little response from the West. So that was presumably how it was read in the Kremlin.
Oh, yes, but the words can be weaponized. Words can be interpreted startlingly differently. And what was manana for most of the Westerners, but not for all, let me say that, you know, Merkel and Sarkozy were worried enough to tell Bush and tell the Americans, you should better stop, because, Bush wanted to go further, not to, even offer a map, perhaps, for Ukraine. Well,
precisely, but they prevailed. I mean, France and Germany prevailed.
They prevailed because they paid more attention to words. You know, for Americans, it was, just a distant promise. But, you know, European powers know history much better than Americans, I think. And they sort of look at the Russian bear and they understand much more. Well, we can argue yes and no, but, you know, at that time, they definitely understood what could happen much better than the Americans. And it sounded provocative to Putin, who had his own trajectory as a former KGB.
Well, was it really a provocation, or was it actually providing him with a pretext?
It certainly wasn't for the Americans, but it was a provocation for Putin at this stage and time of his career. And it was a signal to Mikhail Saakashvili, who sent his troops to Tsinval at the same time, giving a pretext for the Russian forces to crack down against him, invade Georgia. So, you know, it was a signal to multiple participants in different ways.
But even within that perception, as I say, troops did go into Georgia with very little consequence. And then subsequently, there was the move into Donbass, again, with relatively little consequence. You know, I'm basically saying it seems to me that none of this on the West part was really actively hostile to an expansionist Putin position.
That's true. And this is why I'm saying it's, Putin's own evolution from someone who had said in 1991, 92, 93, hey, you know, the Soviet Union is gone. Those who want to restore the Soviet Union have no brains. I mean, he said it. He said that Marx, Lenin were wrong. You know, you need to do something else. You know, he even said to Americans, you know, it was wrong that we were in self-isolation and had a Cold War against you. We gained nothing. So that was Putin one. How it happened that Putin one became Putin two, the one we know today, it's a story of an evolution. What I guess I'm arguing against simplistic telescoping those, 8-10 years into just one.
I mean, what you believe is he moved on from being a Soviet leader to becoming a Russian nationalist leader.
Yep, that's a little bit, he was a Soviet citizen. He was a Soviet KGB officer. Then that was this crash, or Germans say Stunde Null, the zero hour, the Soviet collapse. And many of those people, including Putin, admitted that the Soviet Union is over. We need to learn lessons. He learned many lessons from the Soviet collapse. He didn't learn others, and so on and so forth. But he was prepared to move on. And then later on, he became a sort of a combination of post-Soviet imperialist and Russian nationalist. And, I still struggle myself, and many observers struggle, what is a real mix of all these things in him? But no doubt he uses Russian nationalist rhetoric that is quite different from the Soviet. He still uses, however, Soviet symbols, including during the recent, victory parade. And he's been driven by this erroneous, you may say, maybe misguided desire to stop Western enlargement and Western.
But is it Western enlargement? Or it seems to me that one argument about Ukraine was after the initial revolution and then the Orange Revolution, then the Maidan Revolution, that what was getting under a Russian autocrat's skin was the fact that Ukraine was increasingly wanting to identify itself as a Western-style democracy, and that was a threat which he didn't want to put up with, given its neighbouring status.
Well, it's a matter of accents and emphasis. You know, I think, you know, the all Western observers make an emphasis on democracy. You know, from Putin's perspective, he, I think, made an emphasis on Western at the expense of Russia. And for him, as he repeatedly complained that it should be analyzed and explored, rejected, and so on and so forth, for him, particularly the deal offered by the European Union to Ukraine in 2013, a deal basically of association agreement, but on terms that would have complicated a lot trade with Russia. And the fact that Russia was not invited to the negotiating table, it incensed him. For right or wrong reasons, it incensed Putin. And that was already the point. And I think this point was a culmination of a trajectory that had started earlier, at least in 2011 and maybe in 2008 and so on and so forth. That's debatable. But definitely in 2013, he already thought that Ukraine is a battleground. It's a battleground between the West, where the real master is the United States of America, and him in the Kremlin and Russia. For him, quite surprisingly, the European Union already was a tool of American expansionism. That defies, of course, all our understanding of what European Union stands about. But today, retrospectively, Lavrov, in his last speech, basically said it. You know, of course, we now see that the European Union and NATO are just two arms of the same assault on Russian soil.
Right. I mean, let's talk about this famous 6,000-word essay produced last year by President Putin and the parallel message to NATO and the West, which he released. How shocked were you by that? Or perhaps you weren't shocked. Did it seem to you to be a logical development of the way things were heading? And as a historian, how would you grade the historical analysis and claims made?
Well, I think it's a text that clearly tells us that Putin became an amateur of history in a very serious way. He began to be more and more irritated by Ukraine joining the Baltic countries and other post-Soviet republics in Western orientation, which for him was not just Western and not just democratic. It was a submission to the authority of Washington. And then came this passion for history. It was woken up, by the way, by this acrimony over who started World War II. The Polish right-wing government, conservative government, claimed that Nazism and Stalinism, communism should be, you know, equally condemned. And that incensed Putin. He became interested in this history. He ordered various people to bring him archives. And then he continued to do the same thing in Ukraine. And I think it was fatal. You know, we often find when amateurs plunge into historical research, A, they only find what, you know, to corroborate their preconceived notions. And they're prone to make horribly wrong conclusions from their so-called historical research. And this is what Putin achieved, in a sense, tragically for all of us.
That's a Russian view of the conflict. It is not shared by the United Kingdom and the West, who've rallied to Ukraine's support. So after the years of optimism about Russia, under Gorbachev, Yeltsin, and indeed Putin, where did it all go wrong? For a Western view, I spoke to a veteran Kremlinologist, the UK's former ambassador to Moscow, Sir Roderick Lyne.
You've got to remember what it was like to be a Russian when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. It had happened very quickly. They'd lost an empire in the course of about a year and a half. Then suddenly their own country, the Soviet Union, was falling apart. The economy fell apart. The whole system fell apart. And they did feel deeply humiliated by the crash of their superpower. And, of course, they wanted somebody to blame for it. And if you were Russian in the system, like Putin, the KGB, people like that, you were, of course, part of those who were responsible for the crash of the Soviet Union, so you weren't going to blame yourself. So there's a strand of Russians, of which Putin is one example, and his pal, General Patrushev, another ex-KGB officer from Leningrad, is another, who have forever blamed the collapse of the Soviet Union on a Western conspiracy. And they now advance the thesis, as Putin did in a press conference only last December, that the West is now trying to dismember Russia. Then you had other Russians, the liberal intelligentsia, if you like, who were, of course, delighted that communism had gone, but found themselves responsible, particularly in the government of Yegor Gaidar, which had brilliant young liberal ministers in it, for trying to run the country in a very different way. And they had unrealistic notions about how quickly this could be done. And they were, again, rather unrealistic in the expectations of what the West could do for them. They thought that in some magical way, Russia could be very rapidly put into the European Union, a completely unrealistic notion. But I've had highly intelligent Russian friends arguing to me that the West should have brought Russia straight into the European Union, that we should have dissolved NATO, that there was much more we could have done in the 1990s to create a liberal democratic society in Russia, which they were trying to do. When you look at the facts of the matter, we gave an enormous amount of help to Russia during this period of transition. In fact, starting...
Yeah, I was going to talk about that because I was covering this through the Major and the Blair years. And, you know, my recollection that far from pushing Russia away, the G7 and other institutions, and Britain in particular, all fell over themselves to try and help the Russians.
Well, this started in 1987 when people like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan started getting close to Gorbachev. And from then, really until the end of Putin's first term, we were working very successfully to turn the Russians from adversaries into partners. And, you know, if you stopped the clock in 2003, you would have said this had been a fantastically successful operation by the West to help Russia. In 2003, Russia had a very strong relationship with NATO and the Russia-NATO Council. It was building a strategic partnership with the EU. It had just been granted full membership of the G8, had very good relations with Western countries. We were working together on a whole load of issues. That was the result of 16 years of enormous effort, a lot of expenditure. We were doing extraordinary things. We were helping to decommission nuclear submarines. We were helping the Russians to get rid of chemical weapons. The British, on a budget originally paid for by our own Ministry of Defence, retrained 20,000 Russian officers for civilian life, an enormously successful programme. And I could quote a million and one other examples of what we did in order to help Russia and to make sure that Russia didn't feel excluded or humiliated.
So what went wrong?
Two things. The oil price. In 1998, oil was $10 a barrel. By 2003, it had got up to about 35. It was shooting up towards 100. As the money flowed in, and this really one began to feel in 2003, 2004, it was like oxygen going into the ailing heart of the old Soviet Union. And the Russians started saying, oh, we're not poor anymore. We're rich. We're going to be great again. We don't need Western advice anymore. And Putin then started to junk economic reform, which had been a very successful program.
So it was Putin rather than Yeltsin?
It was Putin. It was 2003. I mean, in Yeltsin's time, Russia was still struggling economically. And it was really the oil price that completely transformed the economy of Russia. And in Putin's first 8 years, he was very, very lucky. Russia grew at an average rate of nearly 7% a year, Russian GDP. So oil was the first thing that changed the mentality. And then the second thing that happened was the Orange Revolution in Kiev, where Putin had invested very, very heavily and personally in the election of his chosen puppet, Viktor Yanukovych. Putin had actually been to Kiev to campaign for Yanukovych. He'd sent his advisors there to help Yanukovych. A rigged election produced Yanukovych as the winner. And then, of course, in the Orange Revolution, it was overthrown by the forces of democracy marshaled on the Maidan in Kiev. And naturally, Western leaders were giving verbal support to the Orange Revolution Democrats.
And Yushchenko was poisoned.
Yushchenko had been poisoned in the course of this. But there was no question.
Is there any doubt that that was the Russians who did that?
I don't know. I can't prove it. It would be consistent with their behaviour. The point of the Orange Revolution was that Putin had spent 4 years building up friendships with people like Tony Blair and George Bush and Chirac, and particularly with Schroeder, who he had practically in his back pocket. Suddenly, Putin found that his Western friends were backing the other side, and he felt betrayed. And I think his chums in the KGB were coming to him and saying, well, you were mistaken all along in being pally with those people. Look what they've done. They've stabbed you in the back.
Can I just ask you about Ukraine at that stage? I mean, how did Russia view Ukraine? Did it recognise its independence at all? Did it see it as part of Greater Russia at that stage in 2003, at the time of the revolution?
Depends how old a Russian you were. If you're a Russian of Putin's generation, he was 40-ish when the Soviet Union collapsed. It was inconceivable, unimaginable idea to you that Ukraine and Belarus in particular should become foreign independent states. And indeed, to Yeltsin too, this wasn't the idea. Yeltsin tried to recreate a form of association.
Or Gorbachev.
Well, Gorbachev was trying to create a voluntary association of the Soviet republics. That failed. That precipitated the coup. Yeltsin then tried to create the Commonwealth of Independent States. Ukraine joined it, but it never ratified the charter. And whenever it was asked to do something within that arrangement that crossed Ukraine's view of its sovereignty, it drew back. So to Russians of that generation, that Ukraine was a foreign country was alien. That has changed over the last 30 years. The younger generations in Russia, the under 40s, the under 45s, have come to accept that Ukraine is a separate state. When you're talking about 2004, you're somewhere in between. But to Putin, controlling Ukraine was a vital objective. And having his own man, Yanukovych, overturned by democracy in Ukraine was the worst humiliation that Putin has endured in his 22 years as Russian leader.
And why was it so vital?
It was vital because in his mentality, Ukraine was part of Russia's security perimeter. Russia dominated the economy of Ukraine. And he had this notion, which his generation shared, that Ukraine was essentially part of Russia. And his theme became that the West must not steal Ukraine away from Russia.
Do you think through this period that perhaps we were a bit gullible and too enthusiastic about working with the Russians? I mean, obviously, Tony Blair and George Bush wanted support or at least acquiescence for the invasion of Iraq. But at the same time, I mean, I remember going back to, I think, 1987, Sir Christopher Mayer, who was then the spokesman for the Foreign Office, referring to Mrs. Thatcher having what he called a gorbasm in terms of her enthusiasm for President Gorbachev. And you know, you were there when Tony Blair made his first visits. I mean, were we just a bit too keen at that level, at leader level, to sort of welcome whoever was the Russian leader into the club?
It's very much in our strategic interests, and it will be again after this war is over, though I'm looking 10, 15, 20 years down the road, that the largest European country should not be a permanent enemy of the rest of Europe, that we shouldn't have this dividing line in Europe. From 1987 onwards, we had a chance to remove that dividing line. We did remove that dividing line. We turned our most threatening enemy into a partner, into a country where we were investing, where we had huge people-to-people contacts, and where we declared solemnly in 1997 in the NATO-Russia founding act, we were no longer adversaries. That was massively in our strategic interests. And Putin, in his first 3 or 4 years as president, was working with the grain. It was his objective to integrate Russia with the West. That, as I say, changed with the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. But we were completely right to work with him in our own interests.
And perhaps a little bit gullible?
Gullible in what sense?
Well, in the sense that we became friendly with someone whose ultimate intentions turned out to be hostile.
Well, I don't think that this was just based on our reading of Putin's personality. I always saw Putin, and I suspect Tony Blair did too, as somebody with a bit of a split personality. You could see in Putin the old KGB officer, suspicious, found it very hard to trust people, had grown up in a very anti-Western environment and was a bit paranoid. That's one side of Putin's brain. There was also the other Putin, who was a rational pragmatist, who, the moment he became president, the very first thing he did as president was to bury the hatchet with NATO. This was less than a year after NATO had bombed Belgrade, which produced a massive breach between Russia and NATO. Putin set out to rebuild relations with the West. He closed Russian bases in Cuba and Vietnam. He took an enormous number of steps. It wasn't just words. It wasn't just his personality. It was what he was doing. He brought a very strong team of reformers into his government, and we were working with them on, for example, their efforts to join the World Trade Organization. So we were judging him not just by his words, but by his actions. And some of those actions were things we didn't like. The war in Chechnya in particular was conducted with great brutality, and Putin was incredibly sensitive whenever the question of Chechnya was raised. When it got to the 2004 presidential election, that was heavily rigged. Tony Blair, I remember, criticised it to Putin at the G8 summit that year. They had quite a spat over it. So, you know, I think we did this on the basis of a calculation of our interests, of Western interests, and of, you know, what Putin and his team were actually doing at the time.
Yeah, it seemed to me, and you can probably disagree, that after you say there was this change in attitude following the Maidan Revolution and all that, that we had things over the years, the Litvinenko poisoning in this country, the Skripals, there were individual sanctions put on. We also had the move into the Donbass, the annexation of Crimea and all of that. And actually, you know, people would now, with hindsight, say, look, the writing was on the wall that something really unpleasant was going to happen. And we were just protesting at the same time on Ukraine as sending out signals that, well, they're not going to join NATO and they're probably not going to join the European Union.
I think there was a sort of downward spiral from 2005. And I do think some people in the West were very slow to pick up on this. I think the Americans under Obama and Hillary Clinton got it completely wrong when they did their famous reset with Russia. I mean, that was after...
Didn't even work.
Well, it didn't work, and it didn't work because there was no foundation for it. I mean, this was in around 2010. It was after the Russian war with Georgia. Putin had gone to Munich in 2007 and made a famous speech bitterly attacking the Americans. That was a sort of wake-up moment, or it should have been for people. 2008, when the Russians attacked Georgia again, serious moment. But what did Nicolas Sarkozy do? He went and engaged in sort of shuttle diplomacy between Georgia and Moscow, and he helped to broker a deal that was very much in Russian favour and effectively allowed the Russians to remain in occupation of two parts of Georgia, of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. He was not nearly tough enough. The EU went on talking about building partnerships of one kind and another with Russia when it was quite obvious that Russia was no longer moving in that direction. So I think the West was slow to pick up in that period and did underreact to some of the events there. There was this enormous desire of particularly some EU leaders, I think less so in Britain than elsewhere, always to think that if you go running to Moscow and you offer concessions to Mr. Putin, that you could do some kind of a compromise deal. Again, they tried that in 2014 after the invasion of Donbass and the annexation of Crimea. The Minsk process was very badly handled by the so-called Normandy parties. Too much, again, was conceded to Russia in this desperate attempt to conciliate Putin. If you offer a concession to Putin, he says, thank you very much, puts it in his pocket and asks for more.
So whose fault is the invasion of Ukraine?
This is Vladimir Putin's war. I mean, if you look at the reasons that precipitated this, you can find a whole range of institutional factors why there has been friction between Russia and Ukraine over the past 20, 30 years, why people of Putin's generation still think that Ukraine should be very closely connected to Russia. But none of those explain the decision to invade on the 24th of February. Most of the Russian elite thought that Putin was bluffing. They thought It was an absolutely crazy decision. I suspect this even extended as far as his prime minister and quite a number of his military commanders, I would speculate. They've studied what happened in Afghanistan to them. They've studied what happened in Iraq. And the idea of invading a country larger than France with 40 million people, they must have done the maths and said, this is mad. This was taken by Putin. This was his own very personal decision, and he got it massively wrong. So, you know, at this point, Russia had been fighting a low-intensity war in Donbass and Luhansk for 7 years. I think Putin was frustrated at his failure. This was his third failed attempt to try to get control of Ukraine. And I think at this point he decided to go for broke. I think he looked at the West and thought, this is a good moment. Americans have got a new administration. It's a bit weak and fluffy, and he's absolutely preoccupied with China. Angela Merkel's about to leave in Germany. The Brits have left the European Union. Europe's very divided. People are very preoccupied with COVID. They've got all kinds of internal problems. And I think he miscalculated the Western reaction, thought that he could get away with it. I think that was one of three miscalculations. He obviously miscalculated the strength of Ukrainian resistance, and he miscalculated the effectiveness of his own army. But this was absolutely personal to Putin.
So do you think there's no chance he will prevail eventually in Ukraine?
He's clearly not prevailing. There is a risk with Putin always that when he is facing defeat, that he lashes out. I don't think we can be complacent about that. But at the moment, all one can say is that he has completely failed in his original objective, which was a very quick takeover in Kiev. He has failed in the second objective, which was still to occupy a large chunk of Ukraine. They're now reduced to fighting over a relatively small area of Ukraine, and that may now end up in some form of stalemate.
I mean, the Russians have taken that corridor down to Crimea, land corridor, and the coast on the Sea of Azov.
Yes, but they haven't made very large gains. What they have done is they've caused massive damage to Ukraine, which is something that Putin has always wanted to do. He's wanted to keep Ukraine weak. But, I mean, that's not what he set out to do at all. Where he will end up is very hard to say. I think some form of stalemate with the Russians holding a little bit more land than they had before the conflict started on the 24th of February is possible at the cost of huge casualties, massive expense, massive damage to their economy, massive loss of military equipment. By any measure, that is a failure. Putin has lost Ukraine forever. He's alienated the Ukrainians, who were not an unfriendly people. They were closely tied to Russia. They were related to Russia. He will go down in Russian history as the man who lost Ukraine and mounted a completely disastrous war that brought no benefit to Russia, did massive damage to his country. And 10 years, 15 years from now, Russians will look back on this as a complete disaster for their country.
And where do you think the Russian people really are on this? We know there's been massive propaganda effort and they're not getting accurate information as to what's going on.
You have to segment the Russian population. I think a lot of them just want this war to end. They don't even want to think about it. You've got people, particularly older people, who get all of their news feed off the television and they've drunk the Kool-Aid that is being poured into them. You've had huge numbers of Russians very bravely protesting. You've had massive numbers of Russians leaving the country since the 24th of February because they simply couldn't abide with what was going on. And that's on top of 2 or 3 million Russians who've left over the last 20 years because they didn't like the way Putin was running the country. It's pretty hard to assess exactly where Russian public opinion lies at this moment. What I'm absolutely certain of is that there is going to be a slow burn effect. One of the factors that will change public opinion, as it did during the Afghan war, is the grapevine spreading word of casualties. You have to remember that the troops who are getting killed mostly don't come from fancy cities like Moscow. They've been mainly recruited from poorer parts of Russia. Most Russian families only have one child. You've got mothers burying their only kid. People around get to know and they say, what was this war for? What are we achieving by doing it? That level of discontent with this war, with the economic effects of the war, is going to feed into a population that was already very discontented with the way that Putin and his gang have been running the country, with corruption, with falling living standards, with poor public services. And there will be a growing, over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, however many years it is, I think, wave of dissatisfaction with Putin's regime.
He, of course, has accused the Ukrainians of being Nazis. But is the truth that Putin's regime has turned into being fascist itself?
I think we've seen a regime that became authoritarian turn, since 2012, progressively into a regime that is now totalitarian. If you look at the laws that they have introduced since the 24th of February, under which you can be imprisoned for 15 years if you refer to this war as a war, if you look at the controls that they are placing on the media, the way that they are running the country, the massive army of security people that they have around Russia, one has to say that this is now a totalitarian regime.
And finally, how do you think the world will be after this? Will it be credible to still have a United Nations led by a United Nations Security Council with Russia on it, come to that with the UK on it?
People have been talking about reform of the United Nations for the last 50 years. I remember it was a topic when I was serving there in the 1980s. And change is very difficult to produce in the United Nations. But we need it, and nobody can produce at this moment a better alternative. You need a body that embraces all of the states of the world where they can communicate with each other. It is a place where, even when we are in conflict or in very sharp dispute, we can talk to the Russians or the Chinese, who are, or whatever it might be. And the United Nations spawns a vast family of international organizations that are doing work in all sorts of different areas that are not necessarily affected by this war or that are vital to the functioning of the international community. You think of the World Food Programme, and we are facing a food crisis now. You think of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and so on. So there are all sorts of improvements you can make to the United Nations, but I don't think it's going to go away, nor should it. We have to keep working at it.
For now, the war goes on, and Russia's eventual global standing will very much depend on the outcome. Please join me for the next edition of Worldview, where we'll reflect more on the war. This podcast is for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer is Mary Jessel, the assistant producer is Eve Webster, and the sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Thanks for listening.